My name is Michael Guyad, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the rough hour is Hal Brands. Hal, appreciate your time here. Introduce yourself to the audience and to me a bit more formally. Who are you? What's your background? What have you done throughout your career? And what are you doing currently?
Sure. And thanks for having me. First off, it's a pleasure to get to spend some time with you and your audience. So my job is I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins University, where I teach at the School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington, D.C. I'm also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and I write a weekly column on foreign affairs for Bloomberg Opinion, in addition to writing for a bunch of other outlets more episodically. I'm a historian by trade. I came up studying the history of the Cold War, and I got my PhD in that about 15 years ago. And since then, I've kind of kicked around the academy while also spending a little bit of time in government at the Department of Defense, working on strategic planning issues, and otherwise kind of immersing myself in the policy world from time to time. So these days, I spend most of my time either chasing kind of the big three, so Russia's war in Ukraine, U.S.-China tensions, or the crisis in the Middle East, while also doing, you know, a variety of more historical work that tries to put today's conflicts and competitions in deeper context.
Maybe a weird way for me to frame the question, but do you get a sense that history is moving faster when it comes to foreign affairs, that things are taking place over shorter time periods compared to history?
It certainly seems like the speed of events has accelerated, you know, really over the past 4+ years. And so if you think about the way that COVID really turbocharged the U.S.-China rivalry and contributed to a really dramatic falling off of support for China in not just the United States, but in advanced democracies around the world. Or if you think about the way that the war in Ukraine has really accelerated the formation of what I've sometimes called the autocratic entente. So the set of relationships between Russia and Iran, Russia and China, Russia and North Korea, and so on and so forth, that the countries that are increasingly supporting Russia as it comes under pressure in Ukraine and are getting some pretty significant benefits in return, while the war has also had the effect of tightening the ties between the U.S. and its alliance partners in Europe and in the Asia Pacific. Certainly, we're seeing sort of a deepening of the global cleavages that had already started to emerge before that. And then, of course, we're seeing the same phenomenon with the crisis in the Middle East. And so the crisis in the Middle East is having a variety of effects. It's demonstrating how geopolitical disruption can cause geoeconomic disruption in the way that the war is spilling over into the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden and then really playing havoc with shipping through those regions. We're also seeing how it can provide a cover for some of the actors that I just talked about to accelerate their activities. And so Iran, even though it has mostly stayed out of the fighting directly, appears to be using the climate of regional confusion and U.S. and Israeli distraction that the war is creating to advance its nuclear program in some troubling ways. And so, yeah, in all three of those cases, we see that crises have the effect of speeding up history and exacerbating trends that are already underway in the international system.
That term crisis and tension, those two terms get thrown around a lot. I think most people tend to think of the extreme in terms of that inevitably leads to war, and China is obviously a big part of those concerns. But arguably, there's a lot of ways that you can have a war without bloodshed, right? I mean, you can have a cybersecurity war, you can have a currency war, which may be potentially at our doorstep. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how geopolitical tensions have increased fragility when it comes to international trade and currency value, because it seems to me that that's where it actually impacts us here in the U.S. as citizens.
Well, there are a handful of ways in which geopolitical tensions can really ripple through into the global economy. And so we've seen a few examples of that over the past few years. And so we saw, obviously, the supply chain disruptions that were created by COVID and its aftermath. We have seen the ways in which international shipping, which is really at the heart of the global economy and, you know, has impacts on the way that Americans live on things as mundane as, you know, how long does it take you to get the thing that you ordered from Amazon? We've seen how shipping timelines have been extended and costs have been increased by the conflict in the Middle East. We saw back in early 2023 how the war in Ukraine had an impact on global food markets. And that was not an issue that I think was felt so much directly in the United States even though it certainly had an impact on a number of more food insecure countries and populations around the world, but then also the way that the war and some of the dynamics associated with it roiled the energy markets in ways that were economically and perhaps politically disruptive in the United States. And so what you have right now, just to kind of simplify things, is you have an international economy that is still very closely and tightly integrated, even though that has gone in reverse a little bit in recent years. But it's playing out in a system that is increasingly upset by geopolitical tensions. And so that combination is likely to produce geoeconomic shocks, geoeconomic implications that will be felt, you know, even by people in the United States.
Integration with tension is probably standard, right, in a globalized economy. When I think about China, I always am skeptical of the real doomsday scenarios, because the reality is there's a degree of mutually assured economic destruction in terms of any kind of real severe conflict between China and the US. What are some of the things that you focus on that you think people get wrong? I know you have a book that you put out, Danger Zone, that's why I renamed the space, you know, The Coming Conflict with China. Maybe lay out some of the thoughts in that and where we are currently.
Sure. So Danger Zone, which was a book that I co-authored with a guy named Mike Beckley at Tufts University, who's a friend and a colleague and a really incredibly brilliant geopolitical thinker, that book advanced two main arguments. The first argument was that China is not doing nearly as well as you think, particularly economically. And so, you know, we conceived this book back in 20, which was still when you were seeing the tail end of kind of the Thucydides trap, superpower marathon, China overtaking the United States type themes in a lot of public and academic discourse. And our argument there was that wasn't going to happen. That wasn't the problem. That the China's economy was already suffering from a handful of very deeply rooted structural problems that were going to be extremely difficult for China to escape. And those structural problems are everything from the demographic crunch that is coming and is in some ways already here with respect to China, sort of the reversal of the reform and opening process that had begun in the 1970s and really climaxed during the 2000s, the increasingly neo-totalitarian turn of the political system, the increasing scarcity of key resources in China, and so on and so forth. And when you put all of that together, China was going to be looking at a future most likely of economic stagnation, where even the official growth numbers, which you really can't rely on, would be dramatically lower than they had been during the 2000s and the 2010s, when we were used to double digit or at least 8% Chinese growth. Now we're really looking at, you know, 5% growth, according to the official statistics, with a lot of people suspecting that the real number is much, much lower. And so that was argument one. So you got to remember, this book came out about 18 months ago. And so that argument seemed a lot more controversial at the time than it does now, because what everybody has observed over the past year plus is that China finally came out of zero COVID and did not get the big rebound that everyone was expecting, in part because of a lot of these deeper structural problems that are now coming into sharper relief. So that was argument one. Argument two was that a stagnant China, a China that was facing growing international resistance to its ambitions from the U.S. and a variety of U.S. allies and partners, not just in the Asia Pacific, but in Europe as well, that could actually be a more dangerous China. Because when you think historically about revisionist powers, so powers that just wish that the system worked differently than it does, those countries tend to become most dangerous not when they are extremely confident about their future trajectory, but when they worry that their power is peaking relative to their rivals and perhaps even starting to decline. That was the position that Germany found itself in just prior to World War I, which is one reason why the German leadership took such extreme risks in the July crisis of 1914. That was in some ways the position that Japan found itself in the run-up to World War II. And so when you get countries that want to change the way the world works, but worry that they are running out of time in which to do so, those countries are more likely to take big risks to lock in gains while they still can. And I'm happy to talk in more detail about sort of the notion of a peaking China economically and militarily and so on and so forth. But the basic concern we had was that you get a China that would be increasingly aggressive in the latter part of the 2020s because it would worry that the future was no longer on its side as you get into the 2030s and beyond.
That, of course, immediately makes me think of, that means they're going into Taiwan soon.
That is one of the concerns. And so, you know, we sketched out a handful of scenarios in which China could become more assertive. I mean, it's everything from really getting tough with India on the shared border and the Himalayas to picking a fight with the Philippines over one of these disputed features in the South China Sea, maybe second Thomas Shoal, where tensions are ticking up right now, you know, maybe taking a swing at Japan and the East China Sea. But the one that I think is most worrying, because the effects would be most catastrophic, would indeed be a Chinese move on Taiwan. And I think you've got a really dangerous combination of influences that are brewing in Beijing right now. And so on the one hand, China's military position vis-a-vis Taiwan and the United States is getting better as we get into the latter part of this decade, because China's military reforms are proceeding. The U.S. is having trouble generating military power on short timelines because of the challenges of defense industrial base. And so the military picture looks better and better from Xi's perspective. The challenge, though, is that the political picture looks worse and worse, because Taiwan has now handed victory three times in a row to the political party, the DPP, that Beijing really doesn't like because it believes that it is dangerously pro-independence. And so you have a scenario where Xi's military options are getting better vis-a-vis Taiwan, while his confidence in China's ability to manipulate the political trajectory of Taiwan is probably decreasing. Whether or not that leads to a big invasion is anybody's guess, and it's a bit of an open question. But certainly, I think it puts us in a position where we're likely to see greater Chinese coercion of Taiwan as the decade goes on.
What about on the currency side? I would think that if you're a major superpower and you're worried about peaking, you're going to most want to protect your currency and try to get more adoption, right? Not quite get to the reserve currency status of the U.S., but try to at least do everything you can to defend it. Yuan has been getting some headlines recently. It looks like China's ordering some of these state-owned banks to come in and support the yuan. How does the currency side impact policy decisions with China?
I think there's a pretty low chance of the yuan ever is a long time, but anytime soon rivaling the dollar as an international reserve currency. And I know that's not what you're saying, but you sometimes hear that. And so it's worth taking a minute just to kind of explain why. And the major reason for that is that the currency just isn't sort of freely convertible in the way that the dollar is. And it's very hard to create a system in which your currency becomes a pillar of the international exchange system if that's not the case. But I actually don't think that that's what China is going for. I think the Chinese government sort of understands the way in which their economic model inhibits the currency from rising to global reserve status. But that's not really what China needs. What China needs is an international financial and economic set of arrangements that insulates the Chinese economy to a degree from the threat of sanctions of the sort that the West has applied to Russia in the context of the Ukraine war. And we are seeing some progress along those lines. If you look at sort of the deepening of economic and financial ties between Russia and China, between China and a number of other countries in the global South, particularly some of the Eurasian autocracies, you can see sort of the beginnings of a Eurasian economic and financial bloc that is going to be oriented toward China, that is probably going to feature payment systems that are less susceptible to U.S. and Western sanctions. And that's a strategic good from China's perspective, because it provides some insulation in case of a crisis between Beijing and Washington.
I know you've put out quite a few pieces on sort of these new alliances that have been forming, new, let's call it, spheres of influence or blocks, for a better way of saying it. Let's talk about some of these newer, stronger alliances that have been forming. I think a lot of people focus on Russia and China, but it's more than just Russia and China.
Yeah, it is. And so you can think of, you know, Russia-China is at the heart of it, because those are the two strongest revisionist autocratic great powers. And so their relationship matters the most. But what we've seen, especially since the Ukraine war began, is the flourishing of a number of these relationships. And so certainly you'd want to include the Russia-Iran military relationship here. You know, this used to be a relationship where, you know, Russia kind of sold Iran some military goods, but not really the state-of-the-art stuff. That's changing in two respects. So now Iran is providing Russia with drones, with the ability to make Iranian drones, with ballistic missiles and other things that are useful in the battlefield in Ukraine, and they're thereby increasing Russia's stamina in that war. And in exchange, it looks like they're going to get more advanced air defenses, more advanced fighter jets, and potentially other defense technology as well. You're seeing the same thing in the Russia-North Korea relationship. And so we don't think of North Korea as being sort of the provider of anything except chaos, but it's provided Russia with, by some estimates, upwards of 3 million artillery shells in the context of the Ukraine war. You know, even if half of those are duds, that's still 1.5 million plus artillery shells, which is really gold in an artillery-centric war like the one that Russia is fighting with Ukraine. So what does North Korea get in exchange for that? It's hard to say, and that's kind of the worrying thing. And so because the Russians haven't been entirely clear about what the quo is for the North Korean quid, we, and I think the South Koreans, suspect that it's happening in areas that are very sensitive, that perhaps the Russians are helping North Korea with their missile programs or with their WMD programs, or otherwise helping them in ways that would help North Korea get to certain military milestones quicker than Western intelligence agencies might suspect. And so if you add in then the Russia-China relationship, what's happened there is that China hasn't provided Russia with arms for use in Ukraine, as far as we know, in large part because the US and Europe threatened China with pretty significant sanctions if that happened. But they've basically given Russia a lot of dual-use goods, so microchips, navigational equipment, things that are technically civilian goods but have lots of military applications. And then just have helped give Putin the economic wherewithal to continue the war, because Russian trade has increasingly been reoriented toward China and toward Asia more broadly. And so if you look sort of across Eurasia, you have this crisscrossing network of strategic relationships taking shape between and among U.S. adversaries. And those relationships, even though they don't look exactly like the alliances that the United States has with its European allies or with its Asia-Pacific allies, they still create very specific geopolitical effects, and they still worsen the challenges that U.S. adversaries pose, both by themselves and collectively, to the U.S.-led international order.
Do you get a sense that those relationships are strengthening or maybe being emboldened by what seemingly is not really helping Ukraine that much anymore, which is all this, you know, constant funding by the U.S. government, right? Kind of sending, you know, the proxy war idea, right? Sending capital to Ukraine to fight Russia. It doesn't seem like it's, first of all, it seems like in the U.S., at least the public sentiment around that is waning in terms of continuing it. But because it hasn't been, I think, maybe as successful in combating, pushing back Russia, is that emboldening some of these other relationships outside of the U.S.?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Well, I think in general, the Ukraine war has created sort of a geopolitical hothouse environment in which tensions rise and countries on both sides of the international dividing line find it necessary to strengthen ties with countries that view things differently. And so we're seeing this on the U.S. side with the expansion of NATO, the revival of NATO, the way that, you know, European countries are investing more in their defense industrial bases and so on and so forth. We're seeing it on the other side of the international dividing line as well. So there's definitely something there. I would just make a couple of points about the Ukraine war. And so one is, I think it is fair to say that the 2023 Ukrainian offensive did not accomplish much of what Ukraine or the United States hoped. It really didn't budge the front lines in any meaningful way. And now, of course, Ukraine is on its back foot a little bit. And so that is a fair critique. But let me make kind of two additional points. The first is that if you think about what expectations for Ukraine were, not in June 2023, but in February 2022, when the war started, well, if that's your starting point, then the war has actually gone remarkably well from Ukraine's perspective, because very few people thought that Ukraine was going to be able to survive as an independent entity after the Russian invasion. Certainly, they thought that Russia would capture much more territory than it's captured to date. And one of the reasons that has not happened is because of all the foreign support that Ukraine has had, whether it was the U.S. intelligence support or the arms and ammunition that the U.S. and European and a few Asian countries were providing, or the defense planning support. It was really crucial in everything from the defense of the capital back in February and March 2022 to, you know, holding the line in the east during the summer of 2022 to retaking the offensive around Kherson and Kharkiv in sort of the late summer and fall of 2022. And so it's worth just taking a moment to know how much Ukraine and its Western partners have achieved over the past 2 years. The final point I would offer about this is that, you know, right now, the problem is not that Ukraine is using American aid ineffectively. The problem is that Ukraine hasn't had any meaningful American aid in several months at this point, because funding for Ukraine aid has been stuck on Capitol Hill, even though it still has majority support among the U.S. public, even though it still has majority support among senators and representatives. It's sort of a weird thing having to do with the narrowness of the Republican majority in the House and then sort of the Trump critique of U.S. aid to Ukraine. If Ukraine doesn't get U.S. aid, I think there is a very significant chance that Ukraine will lose the war in some significant sense. Not that Russia is going to capture the entire country, but that Ukraine will lose additional territory and they will have to make peace on unfavorable terms. If they get more American aid, I think there's every prospect that they can defend effectively over the course of this year and maybe build forces for another offensive or at least a stronger negotiating position in 2025. Finally, and I know I said this is already the last point, but let me add one more. One common misconception about Ukraine aid that is worth addressing has to do with where the money goes. When we talk about Ukraine aid, it sometimes creates the impression that the U.S. is sending a ton of money to Ukraine. What's actually happening is the U.S. is appropriating a bunch of money that is almost entirely spent in the United States, right? And so the way that this works is the U.S. provides artillery shells, for instance, out of its own military stockpiles to Ukraine, and then uses the money that Congress appropriates to replenish those stockpiles. And so the way this works is we give Ukraine older stuff, we appropriate money, and we buy newer stuff to replace it with. And so this is actually not a bad deal for the U.S. military, which comes out of it with better kit. It's actually a very good deal in terms of the U.S. defense industrial base, because this money is helping to expand production of artillery shells and other important goods that would be useful in a variety of different geopolitical contexts. And so I think that the aid issue, despite how it's sometimes framed, it is much more of a positive sum game for the United States than a zero sum game.
One of the headlines that been making the rounds comes from JP Morgan, which is arguing that Putin can push oil to $100 in advance of the election. You constantly hear these arguments being made about Putin impacting the U.S. through the mechanism of oil. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I am curious to hear your thoughts on just how much sway Putin has through oil as an influencing factor happens to domestic politics.
Well, one way of thinking about this is to recognize that the U.S. has been deliberately pulling its punches on the Russia sanctions precisely because of the dynamics that you talk about. And so the sanctions that the U.S. and Europe have imposed on Russia have not been meant to take Russian oil and gas off of the market altogether. in the way that the United States tried to do with Iran during the Trump years, where the idea was simply to drive Iranian oil sales down as close to zero as possible. The U.S. and Europe have not done that in the Russia context because they are fearful that that would be profoundly disruptive to the global economy, including the economies of several Western democracies that are coming into elections in the coming months, Britain and the United States being the most important of those, but also because it would dramatically increase the global economic pain that the war causes, including for some of the more ambivalent countries, many of them in the global South. And so, you know, if you were to really take Russian oil off the market, that would have a pretty significantly negative effect on India, for instance, which is a country that the United States is trying to cultivate geopolitically in the U.S.-China context right now. And so certainly fear of economic disruption has been one of the reasons why the U.S. and EU have pursued this approach of trying to reduce the price that is paid for Russian energy resources and redirect those energy resources away from Europe to decrease the strategic dependency that Europe had on Russia, but not to take those things off the global market altogether.
Speaking about oil, I had a person on a space, I'm in a bunker, talking about OPEC and oil. And, you know, we talked about, a little bit about this idea of geopolitical tensions impacting, you know, OPEC member decisions. And she seemed to be skeptical that that really does have any kind of major impact. It's just something that's often said in the headlines, but doesn't actually make too much of a difference in practice. Let's talk about the evolution of OPEC on the geopolitical stage in terms of their influence on global oil, in terms of their political ambitions, anything there that you can add some color to.
Yeah, I mean, I won't pretend to be sort of an energy markets expert, but one thing that has been interesting to watch over the past 18 months or so has been the evolution of the Saudi approach in particular. And then Saudi is obviously sort of the keystone of OPEC. And certainly the Arab part of OPEC is as well. And if you go back to the summer and fall of 2022, MBS sent a rather sharp jolt through Washington by going ahead with production cuts on the eve of the U.S. midterm elections in a way that sent oil prices higher at a time when the Biden administration was very concerned about a Democratic wipeout in the midterms. Now, of course, that wipeout didn't materialize quite in the way that people were worried about. But nonetheless, this was really seen as a pretty strong arm move from MBS in dealing with a president, Joe Biden, that he simply had not gotten along with. It was also part of a broader Saudi repositioning geopolitically, or at least the threat of such a repositioning. And that was followed up in early 2023 by the announcement that China had brokered a diplomatic normalization agreement, basically a resumption of normal diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And this, too, I think, sent a certain number of shockwaves through Washington because it raised the specter that Saudi Arabia, which had really been at the heart of the U.S. strategic position in the Persian Gulf for decades, was now realigning itself in this contest between the United States and China and Russia. And so since then, I think what's become clear is that MBS's preferred posture is still to have the U.S. as his primary partner, particularly in security and intelligence terms, where the U.S. can just provide benefits and assistance of a sort that neither the Russians nor the Chinese can. But what he was doing was basically showing how much trouble he could make for the United States as a way of driving up the price of his alignment with the United States. And so what's happened over the past year is that MBS has made clear that he actually wants a deeper security relationship with the U.S. And he wants something that the United States has never given Saudi Arabia in the past, which is a more formal defense guarantee, somewhat akin to the North Atlantic Treaty or U.S. alliances with countries in the Asia Pacific, in addition to a civil nuclear program, in addition to more sophisticated weapons and a variety of other things. And he's going to get it, most likely. And so the way this is supposed to play out is that Saudi Arabia and Israel will normalize relations at some point, presumably after the war in Gaza is over. And the U.S. will basically provide side payments to the two parties to get them to make this deal, which will help create a stronger anti-Iran axis in the Middle East. And what the U.S. will get out of this as well is a certain limitation of China's relationship with Saudi Arabia. And so presumably you'll get some restrictions on the degree of technological interdependence that Saudi will pursue with China. They're going to deal where the Saudis won't allow Chinese military bases in their country, and so on and so forth. And you'll also presumably get a Saudi commitment to providing some stability in the global oil market. And indeed, if you look at Saudi moves over the past year or so, they have not been disruptive from a U.S. perspective in the way that they were in late 2022. They really have emphasized a greater degree of stability in the markets. And so that's an important evolution to track, and it has a lot to do with the larger geopolitical panorama in the Gulf and globally.
And it is interesting. It does seem like Saudi Arabia in general is going through a bit of a, maybe renaissance is too strong of a word, but yeah, their economy is thriving, and it seems like there's just in general better progress politically going on.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's been a huge amount of domestic change since MBS emerged as the de facto leader of that country several years ago. And just to be clear, it's still a thoroughly autocratic system, still deeply repressive in many respects. And yet there has been significant progress in terms of allowing greater participation by women in aspects of society, whether that's, you know, driving or, you know, going on dates without male chaperones or whatever the case may be. MBS has also really limited the power of the conservative religious establishment in Saudi Arabia, which had stood in the way of a lot of these more progressive domestic changes, but had also been at the heart of sort of spreading Wahhabism internationally in ways that sometimes fueled jihadist activities. And so, the irony is that you've had tensions foregrounded in the U.S.-Saudi relationship over things like the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who was the Saudi journalist, a U.S. permanent resident who was murdered by agents of MBS back in 2018. And you certainly don't want to downplay those issues. But in some ways, the broader evolution of Saudi politics over the past 5 years has been relatively positive from the U.S. perspective in terms of making a society that's still deeply authoritarian somewhat more open and tolerant, really, than it has been at any time in the modern era.
How do you expect this election to play out in terms of the next 4 years of geopolitical dynamics? Meaning, you know, if Trump were to get reelected, what changes when it comes to our relationship with China versus what's gone on now? I mean, the reality is tariffs never really went away with Biden, right? Just from an economic perspective, obviously there's other dynamics there too. Russia, Ukraine, clearly another wild card, but talk through some scenario analysis on Trump getting reelected, what changes?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Yeah, so it's a little bit hard to say at this point because we don't know quite who would be around Trump in the second term. But my assumption is that the folks around Trump would be Trumpier in the second term than they were in the first term. And so what happened in the first term was that Trump surrounded himself with a bunch of establishment types, mainly because there just weren't a lot of MAGA foreign policy advisors and intellectuals in the system at that point. And so those advisors, whether it was, you know, Jim Mattis as the Secretary of Defense or Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State, tended to have a somewhat constraining effect on Trump's ability to put his own preferences into action. My expectation is that will be different the second time around because Trump has learned the lesson of the first term. And, you know, the lesson is don't appoint people who fundamentally disagree with you on policy issues, and in many cases don't appear to like you very much personally, to key positions within your administration. So I would expect we will get a somewhat purer version of MAGA/America First in the second term than we did in the first term. Now, in terms of what that means on, say, US-China relations, the reality, as you pointed out, is that there will be a fair degree of continuity, just in the same way that Biden really maintained and in some ways expanded upon a number of Trump-era initiatives in his own presidency, whether that was the tariffs or the tech controls. Under Trump, the U.S. went after Huawei. Under Biden, it went after the Chinese sort of chip industry more broadly. And so there will still be a significant amount of competition in the relationship. The U.S. and China will still define each other as geopolitical enemy, number one. I think there are maybe two areas where you could see, two examples of areas where you could see a meaningful difference between Biden and Trump, even if it's a subtle difference. And so one is that, the Biden administration has said that it prefers sort of a narrow, selective decoupling with China, not a broad-based decoupling, but one that's really focused on areas where there's a real national security implication. That's broadened out a fair amount over time, but still that's Biden's preference. I think there are people around Trump who would like to see a more broad-based economic decoupling between the United States and China, people like Robert Lighthizer, for instance. And so you could see an increase in economic frictions as a result of pursuit of that decoupling, or simply because Trump is going to layer additional tariffs on Beijing as a way of pursuing whatever trade agreement he hopes to achieve with China. That's one difference. The second one might involve Taiwan. I think Trump is far less persuaded of Taiwan's strategic importance to the United States than Biden is. And he said a number of times in the past that if China were to attack Taiwan, there's just nothing the U.S. can do about it. I don't think that's true, but nonetheless, that's the way he feels about it. And so you'd get a U.S. president who was somewhat less committed to the security of Taiwan than Biden has been, but one who's also willing to sort of weaponize the Taiwan issue for leverage in the broader U.S.-China relationship. And so back in December 2016, after he was elected the first time, Trump took a congratulatory call from Tsai Ing-wen, the president of Taiwan, which was the first time, a Taiwanese leader and an American leader had interacted at that level in decades. It really annoyed Beijing. And so you could see Trump do that sort of thing because he thinks it gives him leverage in the broader relationship. And so that's potentially kind of a fraught combination. If you have a U.S. president who's less committed to Taiwan, but more willing to weaponize it. On the Russia issue, just briefly, Trump has given every indication that he doesn't think the war in Ukraine is going particularly well. He would like to bring it to an end, presumably through some sort of negotiation. Look, Trump tried to bring off a bunch of big deals during his first term, and he succeeded on relatively few of them because they often demanded a degree of discipline and preparation that a Trump administration found it hard to summon. I think that could indeed happen again here. And so if Trump just sort of goes to the Ukrainians and Russians and says, hey, it's time to end the war now in February 2025, one or both parties might simply say no. They might say, look, we're not done fighting yet, right? The Ukrainians aren't done liberating their territory. The Russians aren't done trying to gain more of that territory. And so if that negotiation falls apart, then the question of what Trump does next, I think, is anybody's guess. And because he personalizes policy so much, it might depend on who he blamed for the failure of the first initiative, right? And so if the Russians go along with it, but the Ukrainians buck, then he might, blame the Ukrainians and cut off aid. If it looks like Putin, who has done him wrong, maybe he increases aid. And so after that sort of first move, it becomes a lot harder to predict what might happen.
I got to say, I think it's hard to envision, since you use that term, economic decoupling. I find it hard to imagine that you can do that at this point in the cycle with any degree of efficacy, because economic decoupling implies more inflation because you're getting rid of the labor arbitrage, right, from globalization. And that becomes challenging because part of the geopolitical dynamic is just, debt and who owns it.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that is one of the reasons why the Biden administration has been disinclined to pursue a broader based economic decoupling. But, there's maybe two or three things to keep in mind. One is that even though, nobody's talking about a total decoupling, but the areas of the U.S.-China economic relationship that are going to be controlled in some way or another those areas have broadened just over the course of the Biden administration. And so, you know, you had the semiconductor controls back in October 2022. You've had outbound investment regulation, which is now subject to the rulemaking process. And, you know, most recently, you've had sort of the first shot fired in what I anticipate will ultimately be, you know, significant U.S. and allied restrictions on access of Chinese-made EVs to their domestic markets. And so if you just think about sort of the three areas that the Biden administration has said where it thinks the U.S. needs to fairly aggressively use controls in order to protect competitiveness and advantages, well, those three areas are advanced computing / AI, biotech and biomed, and clean / green energy. Those are three pretty expansive pieces of the modern economy. And then if you throw in the new concerns about data security, well, that's potentially broadening the area that could be controlled to encompass the Internet of Things, which as you know, is enormous, right? And so the Biden administration has talked about this small yard, high fence approach, but the reality is that the yard is getting steadily larger with time. So that'd be point one. Point two is that this is being driven from the Chinese side as well. And so as the Ministry of State Security increasingly dominates policymaking within China, we are seeing the foregrounding of national security concerns in ways that are going to drive a degree of decoupling from the Chinese side. And so if, when you have, you know, MSS or the police raiding the accounting firms or the consulting firms that are doing due diligence or helping out with mergers or acquisitions involving foreign companies and Chinese companies, that obviously sends a signal, right? When you see that China is trying to indigenize production of as much critical technology as possible, right? That's going to drive decoupling as well. And so this process is going to play out slowly, and it's never going to be a complete decoupling, but I would expect that it will have expanded significantly from where it is today, 5 to 7 years from now, even if current trends continue. The third point and the last point I'll offer here is that I didn't really get into this before, I don't think Trump is actually a decoupling hawk. I think there are people in a Trump administration who would genuinely like to see a much deeper and broader decoupling between the U.S. and China. I'm not sure that Trump is one of them. During his first term, he applied a lot of tariffs, but the tariffs were meant to generate leverage to produce this big, beautiful trade deal, which he thought was going to materialize in 2020. We all remember sort of the phase one trade deal announcement, I believe it was in January 2020, so about 6 weeks before COVID really upended the world and the United States. There's a non-trivial chance that Trump would try to run the same playbook in his second term, right? To show that he is uniquely capable of delivering this deal that will resolve the economic frictions between the U.S. and China. But even if that's the case, even if that's his strategy, the tactics that he uses will include things like higher tariffs, broader tariffs, and they will create bureaucratic running room for people who do actually want a sharper decoupling between the U.S. and China. And so I agree with you that I don't think we're ever going to get to a full-on U.S.-China economic decoupling. I don't think that would be a good thing economically or strategically. But my suspicion is that under Trump or Biden, we will have two economies that are less tightly interwoven 5 years from now than they are today.
So we touched on Russia, Ukraine, China, Middle East. From your vantage point, I'm curious to hear what you think are underplayed geopolitical risks that you don't often hear about, but yeah, it could become a bigger issue over time.
Yeah, I mean, one of them is North Korea. So, you know, there has been some pretty concerning rhetoric coming out of the DPRK in the past few months that has led some North Korea watchers to suggest that they think Kim Jong-un has made a strategic decision for war. I don't think that's true. I think if that were true, it wouldn't make much sense for him to sell, you know, 3 million artillery rounds to Russia, because if North Korea is going to war, it might need those things itself. I do think it is not a trivial possibility that we will see a more bellicose North Korea doing things like provocations below the threshold of outright war. And so there were a couple incidents 15 years ago where North Korea shelled a South Korean island, or it torpedoed a South Korean naval vessel. And so you could see things, you know, provocations of that order of magnitude. What would make it more flammable this time around is that this South Korean government has made clear it's not just going to sit back and let that happen. It will respond if these sorts of things are done. And so you could get a certain escalatory dynamic there. And so that would be one crisis worth watching. I mean, the other one just involves, you know, Haiti and sort of the state of Latin America more broadly. If you think about the region, Latin America is trending in a bad direction on a variety of different metrics, economic and political, in ways that I think are going to complicate U.S. influence there. Haiti has basically experienced a total collapse of governance in ways that are going to create a severe humanitarian crisis that is going to further add to the stresses in that regard. And so these things aren't getting as much attention as the war in Ukraine or the war in the Middle East or tensions with China, but they could have some pretty disruptive effects as well.
Hal, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, more of your work, where would you point them to and maybe do a quick pitch on the book too?
Sure. So you can follow my weekly stuff at Bloomberg, where I have an ongoing column. I have an edited book that is just out today, in fact. It's called War in Ukraine, and it is a compilation of essays from a real who's who in the field on the origins, the course, and the implications of the war. And then I have another book coming out at the very beginning of 2025, which is called The Eurasian Century. And it is about the way in which great power conflicts dating back to the 19th century have shaped the world that we live in today.
Everybody, please check that out, as well as make sure you follow Hal Brands here. I'm going to have this as an edited podcast in a couple of days, and stay tuned in about 10 minutes. I have another space. Hopefully I'll see you all there. Appreciate it, Hal. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.